And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, who can we find in Chapel Hill to explain to us the consequences of President Obama's dismissal of General Stanley McChrystal and every other thing that flows from this action and the kinds of important choices that it places before us and our country again? Of course, the person I always turn to is Dick Cone, Professor Richard H. Cone, the professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, known throughout the country, really throughout the world, as a specialist in civilian and military relations, and former chief of chief of Air Force history in the 1980s. So, Dick Cone, you're away from Chapel Hill, but you've agreed to visit us by telephone from the cool environs of wherever you are, and talk to us about what must have been for you both a most interesting and, I guess I'm surmising, disturbing recent events related to General McChrystal's comments as recorded in Rolling Stone and then the actions that were taken in response to that. Are you more interested or more disturbed about all of this?
Well, I'm equally so, DG, but first I must say thank you for having me on your show. It's an honor to talk to our friends and colleagues in Chapel Hill. I was frankly surprised, first of all, that an officer of such a distinction and success would exercise such bad judgment. But much further and much more disturbing are the attitudes that he expressed. And even beyond that, those attitudes that he let permeate his immediate entourage, he must have fostered them with his own attitudes, and those are enormously unprofessional attitudes. They border on the criminal under Article 88 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which prohibits contemptuous language to the civilian leadership. And so what disturbs me most deeply is that he himself would have these attitudes, that his senior officers around him would have them, and that they are likely more widespread in the military than we imagined before. So it's very unfortunate. The question is this a single incident or one of a few? Or is it a canary in the coal mine?
What was it that he said what were the things that he said that, as you say, bordered on the criminal and were so disturbing to you? And which ones of those things might?
Well, what bordered on the criminal was the contempt and disdain for the vice president. Biden, who's he? And then one of the officers said, "Biden, you mean bite me?" But towards the president, he apparently characterized his meeting with the president as one in which the president was either uneasy or unprepared for that meeting. And if that was the case, or if General McChrystal thought so, he should have kept it to himself.
Is that right, Dick? I'm not taking up for General McChrystal, but as we deal in at high levels of government or even in low levels of business, mm-hmm. if I go in and have a meeting with my superior, mm-hmm. and I come back and report to a colleague, it just like this, I had this meeting with the president the president of the company, and he just didn't seem to engage with me. He didn't seem to understand what I was talking about. He didn't seem to be prepared to talk about it, and I'm frustrated about it. And I say that to a colleague.
Well, I think that's true, and I think there's always a certain amount of frustration and with one's superiors and attitudes. But that we are not talking about the same kinds of people or the same kinds of situations, D.G., that the military is a very special group in society. They have coercion in their hands. They're the most powerful group physically in society. And we have constructed since earliest colonial days particular norms and procedures for having this powerful group in our midst, in our society, to protect us without permitting them the latitude to be able to overthrow our civilian institutions and assume power themselves.
Let me press you just on this one point a little bit.
And the Constitution pervades the Constitution.
But as devil's advocate or for whatever purpose, General McChrystal has a staff that supports him and has to know what he's thinking and what his worries are and help him prepare to deal with the situation as it is. And it seems to me that taking this in its most positive light, it is fair for him to describe to his colleagues in an appropriate way that he doesn't think the president understands well enough what the situation is or is focused on it enough, that in an appropriate way, a general may call his staff into his confidence as they try to do the right thing in presenting carefully and forcefully the ideas that they think it's important for the president to understand. And if the president is in a zone somehow, can't they discuss this and can't they talk about how they can make their presentation better?
Well, you may think it's fair from your perspective, DG, or from mine, or from a civilian perspective, but it's also inappropriate and unprofessional and, in fact, dangerous, as we found out when such views of the president begin to spread amongst a staff. I think it would be appropriate very privately if General McChrystal thinks he needs some help or some guidance in how to deal with it, to bring it up with his most senior colleagues in a most confidential way. His immediate superior, General Petraeus, probably the most skilled and shrewd senior officer in the armed forces in civil military relations, and he could have done so with Petraeus to figure out, well, how am I going to deal with this? There is a strict code in the military about respect for civilian superiors, and he broke it. And the fact that almost universally throughout the military, people believed that the president should fire him.
Yes, of course.
It's indicative of that.
Yeah, I want to get to that. And I'm just trying to explore possible options and trying to understand why, as you pointed out, that the shocking thing about this was why one of the most senior military officers in our country
and respected
got off track. And I'm trying to figure out, more than just arguing about whether or not he was off track, how he got off track. And one of the scenario that I've described was one of the ways that I explored. The other was that as a senior military official, or as I think the most senior, but maybe a senior military official in charge of an operation in a foreign country that required cooperation of both the military and the civilian leadership in a complex operation where the general is required to be both military commander and diplomat and the leader of sort of a reconstruction of a country, mm-hmm. in cooperation and coordination with a whole group of other people who have similar responsibilities, that he becomes a competitor. He's required to become a competitor in terms of placing of doing his job, which goes beyond combat operations and into diplomacy, that as a diplomat and as dealing with a core of competing officials, and some of whom must be difficult to get along with, that he has to take account of and to evaluate and to form rivalries with his colleagues. Now, and so you know that the, or I would say, I would argue that probably the civilian officials who are operating in Vietnam are talking about what a terrible difficulty it is to deal with General McChrystal. So that there are these, this is more than just being a commander of troops. This is being sort of the viceroy of American interest.
That's sometimes the case, but there was a team in Afghanistan, one of whom was a general he knew, but they were not close, the ambassador, Carl Eikenberry, and the other a most skilled but also most difficult diplomat in Richard Holbrooke. But this is a man whose entire life has been devoted to discipline. And that discipline is not just physical courage and danger in combat, but discipline in a variety of difficult political military situations. And you know, the idea that he could have a better relationship with Hamid Karzai, the head of Afghanistan, than he would with his own ambassador or his own special envoy is simply a lack of discipline or of understanding, or of frustration that he did not keep to himself and away from his staff, which is what he needs to do. It's part of the job. And so you have to say to yourself, as you are, you know, how did this happen? Why did this happen? After all, this is not an inexperienced man. He spent most of his career, particularly the last 5-plus years, in the very secret world of special operations. His enormous success, I'm told, in Iraq and in hunting down al-Qaeda and insurgents. So he's a very skilled soldier, but he also spent a year at the Kennedy School at Harvard University on a fellowship, a year as a fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations. He was a spokesman for the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, so it's not that he lacks the experience or the skill. It's also possible he's very tired, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Dick Cohn, let's take a quick break and then come back and continue our discussion. Professor Richard Cohn is my guest. He's the professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and an expert known throughout the world for his interest in and wisdom in civilian military relations. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Professor Richard Cohn, and we're talking about the circumstances of the dismissal of General Stanley McChrystal, trying to fiddle around and understand a little bit better than what was at the surface. You mentioned at the break, Dick Cohn, that the idea that General McChrystal has been involved very deeply in special operations, in the planning of, you know, sort of off-the-book operations, out of the ordinary. The kinds of things that we look to when we want a dramatic impact, go behind enemy lines, blow up things, negotiate with guerrillas, do all sorts of things that are unusual. And having had just a long time ago a brief and very much at the outer limits of contact with these kinds of military officers, very capable, smart, willing to think out of the box, but also a culture develops of we're special. We're called upon to think out of the box and outside the rules that generally govern regular operations. We just have to be a little bit more aggressive, and all of this for the good, and all of this for the right result. But we're special, and we can't be bound by the rules that have other people. I mean, you understand. I mean, you encountered some people like this, I guess.
Yes, I have, and I think that what you describe is the case. They are bound, however, by rules. They're not totally out of control. In fact, because they engage in very secret, very dangerous operations. In this case, targeting particular enemies. Means that they do very careful planning, and they're very highly trained and highly disciplined, as well as courageous. But I think the most important thing about this is that they operate in secret. They operate out of the public eye, and they are not called upon, nor should they be, to discuss these matters with the public. So, I mean, for years, I suspect General McChrystal did not deal with the press very much and did not really think about that very much.
Well, that leads to the my final question about the McChrystal matter, and that is, and you've been monitoring this situation, so maybe you can give more information. But I cannot, the thing that I cannot understand is, even if he were having these conversations in confidence with his staff, which I understand, which I'm more willing to tolerate than you are, based on your long experience, but no one would believe that anybody would say these things in front of a reporter. How, I mean, what happened?
Well, you could write it off to lack of judgment, but you could also write it off to lack of a full comprehension of the professional norms to express those to anyone outside the defense community or even one's closest associates and peers. It was also expressed that he voted for President Obama. And, you know, voting is a very sensitive thing in the military and should be kept strictly private. I think, at least as far as we can reconstruct the circumstances, that this reporter was allowed in Europe, and then they were kind of marooned together for several days because of the volcanic ash. They couldn't get back to Afghanistan. And so the reporter was present for a lot of kind of let-your-hair-down situations. And the group was not careful enough to say to him, this is all off the record. None of this is to be reported. The circumstances, the behaviors, the thoughts, the speech, etc. And they weren't very careful about it. It's also true that General McChrystal was using a contractor to manage some of his relations with the press. And that struck me as bizarre. He wouldn't have the finest public information officer the Army could supply him, or in fact any of the military services could supply him. So it was probably a mistake, a perfect storm of mistakes that occurred here. But I think that when people say, you know, what jumps to mind first is the mistake of letting a reporter in or being candid with a reporter, and, oh my gosh, Rolling Stone of all places, which would be calculated to be not very favorable to the military, really misses the much more significant point about the attitudes. And that in itself is a little disturbing to me, too, DG, that so much commentary had to do with those extraneous things and not with the issues that really forced the president to relieve him, that and the lack of trust. The president couldn't trust him anymore.
I want to go on two different pathways that are really inconsistent with each other.
Mm-hmm.
One is that assuming that these attitudes and the way that General McChrystal dealt with them is an isolated incident.
Let's hope
let's just assume that for a moment, and we'll mm-hmm. attack the assumption. But assuming that that's the case, then you'd have to say it was healthy that this came out and that it was resolved, and that a general officer in a very important position who was expressing these attitudes and felt them mm-hmm. was removed, notwithstanding the difficulties, some of which we might be able to discuss later on, but notwithstanding the challenging difficulties that a change in command presents, that this was fortunate that we found this out and mm-hmm. that we got somebody in place who knows the rules and respects appropriately civilian authority. So was it a good thing that this happened and that we were able to deal with it?
In that very narrow sense, I think it was, and that the president dealt with it swiftly and appropriately. he honored General McChrystal for his long service and his successful commands. I believe they're going to waive the rule that requires him to be so many years at his present rank so that he can retire as a four-star general.
Well, I don't want to interrupt you, but that got my dander up that that a general officer who's 55 years old or however old he is and probably will live to be 85 or 90 or retires at $160-some thousand rather than $140,000 as he would as a two-star general. And I realized that out of our military budget, we're going to be paying millions of dollars to for the retirement pay of a person who's going to go out and get a job, get a second job, making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
Well, at DG, you can say that. I can understand your feelings, but there's both a practical and I think a moral issue involved here. The practical issue is how are you going to get Americans to engage in this kind of service with these kinds of dangers and difficulties? Subject themselves to military discipline and to the chain of command and go into harm's way.
You argue that they're doing it for money?
No. What I'm saying is that you have to reward them appropriately, and I think it's just that they are. I mean, the men and women who make it to this kind of rank are people who could be making tens of millions of dollars in the civilian economy, in business or elsewhere, and it raises larger questions about the justice of compensation in this society for entertainers and athletes and senior executives in business and so on. But you know, the difference between $149,000 and $170-some thousand over 30 years is nowhere near what we are talking about for the golden parachutes that people in business get for failing. they get fired.
I tell you what,
tens of millions.
I apologize. This is off. This is important. I don't want to say this, but I made a mistake raising it in the context of the serious matters, the even more serious matters that we're talking, and I apologize. I'm going to take a breath, catch my breath, apologize to you, and then Dick Cohn and I will be right back to continue our discussion of the consequences of the dismissal of General Stanley McChrystal. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Dick Cohn. He's a professor of history at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, a former leader of the curriculum in history in peace, war, and defense, and acknowledged expert in the realm of civilian-military relations, and that's where we're exploiting his expertise now. Dick, before I got off on a tangent, we were exploring the alternatives of what was going on in the armed services today. The first was that General McChrystal's public comments were, and as they reflected what was going on inside the private conversations of the military officers, that this was an isolated incident, and therefore it was good to, I mean, arguably it was good to find out about it and to take care of it, and by the removal of McChrystal. The other more disturbing, and I'm afraid probably more likely, is that this is a symptom of discussions that are going on or that might be going on at high levels in the military about the civilian authorities, and that, you know, we just don't have a Rolling Stone reporter to report that to us. And I wonder there's no way for you or for me to know, but what is your feeling about this?
Well, I've had some correspondence with officers and discussed it amongst knowledgeable people. And our sense is that it's much more widespread than it ought to be, and in that sense, very disturbing. But to give it a larger context, there has been, you know, throughout history, a grumbling about civilian authority on the part of senior commanders, you can go all the way back to the Peloponnesian War and even before. And so it has existed. It's somewhat natural because the two sides come from different worlds, have different requirements, needs, and have different objectives in trying to engage in military activity. But that said, that is the reason, and other reasons also, why in the last two centuries we have developed in this country and throughout Western militaries and most militaries very strict protocols about how the two deal with each other and the kinds of attitudes, at least on the military part. One can't really expect to impose any set of attitudes on the civilians because they come and go. They're elected. They're appointed. Who knows? They're varying competence and knowledge. But you develop in a professional military professional attitudes and behaviors and understandings that assure that you can maintain liberty and see to your security. So I think that's what really was involved here. And I think most of us believe that it's more widespread than it ought to be, and it calls into question to some degree the way in which the senior military are being chosen, the way in which they're mentoring the people coming up through the ranks, and the extent to which the professional military education system, staff colleges, war colleges, even at the beginning of pre-commissioning in the academies and ROTC and OCS, are explaining civil-military relations in general and civilian control of the military in particular.
That they're not doing a good enough job of this, in your mind? Is that the point? Or
I wouldn't want to characterize them as doing a poor job. I would say that they are not devoting enough attention to it.
I see.
And they're not, the senior people are not devoting the attention to it, are not themselves cognizant enough of it. And one friend of mine who teaches a course on civil-military relations at the National War College gets only a handful of students every year, and all of them say, "My God, why didn't we know this before?
Oh, well.
Why weren't we trained and educated in this before? Shouldn't every officer who's going to the highest ranks be having a course, particularly in civil-military relations?" And the answer is yes, they should, and it is, I think, a flaw in the system.
Let me ask you this. This came up as a consequence of General McChrystal's dismissal and the appointment of General Petraeus to go back online and take charge, and requiring a Senate confirmation so that General Petraeus comes to the Hill. It didn't work out the way I feared it would, but a military officer who's respecting civilian authority is called upon to give his honest opinion to a group of politicians who may disagree with the president about how to handle the war, what the course of the war is. And so the general officer is under oath required to give answers that from people who are seeking to have the general officer say that he thinks differently from the president about how to handle the particular situation, whether it's in Afghanistan or Iraq or some other military challenge.
It's a very old problem, and it's a problem for which most senior officers are not prepared. Because it goes to the very heart of their professionalism and their integrity. But officers have to understand, and I don't think they're educated fully enough in this, in that they are also under the control of Congress. Congress is not in their chain of command, but the Congress exercises important and very widespread authorities over the military. And so they have to be prepared to explain why they support the policy of the president or the administration that they're serving. But also they have to be prepared to give their own particular views of issues without revealing their advice to their civilian superiors. It's a ticklish problem. I'll tell one interesting story, a fun story of a chairman of the Joint Chiefs who asked his legal advisor what would happen if the Congress ordered him to explain something that the president had specifically ordered him not to discuss. And my friend, a very distinguished military lawyer, said, well, General, what you do is you roll your eyes and clutch your chest and fall out of your chair. when the door closes on the chairman's suite at Walter Reed Medical Center, you open your eyes and you go over to the red phone and you pick it up and you say, Mr. President, I will not perjure myself in front of the Congress. Give me new orders. I mean, what that says is that you're between a rock and a hard place, and you have to figure that out for yourself.
Well, we're visiting with Professor Dick Cone. We're talking about the consequences of the dismissal of General Stanley McChrystal and some of the related challenges that members of the military and members of the civilian leadership face. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Dick Cone, our favorite professor of history and peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, at least when it comes to talking about civilian-military relationships. Dick, there's so much else to talk about. I want you to talk briefly because it becomes less controversial. It seems to be less controversial, but how did President Obama handle this situation?
Well, I think he handled it almost perfectly. He had a very good ear for it. He didn't act precipitously. He took the authority on himself. He didn't just say to the Secretary of Defense, well, you know, relieve that man. He's no longer useful to us. I've lost trust in him. He's violated norms. He called McChrystal back to Washington in order to make a visible and prominent and well-known incident of it, because it was egregious. He gave him the courtesy of a private meeting, and it took him 2 days to do this, and he thought through the consequences of both relieving McChrystal, how he would relieve him, and whom he would put in his place. I think the only mistake, and it's a minor one amongst us aficionados of these issues, is that he said he accepted McChrystal's resignation. Well, resignation is a fig leaf in this. Senior officers don't resign. There's no tradition of it, and it would be improper anyway. You don't say, all right, I won't serve the president or the American people anymore, and I'll over some point of principle or policy, I'll abandon my troops. That's not the function of the military. They serve at the pleasure of the president and essentially of the Congress.
Oh, that's interesting to me, Dick Cone. I always learn something from you. But so that it's not appropriate, even when a senior military official loses the confidence of the president and the president doesn't ask for his resignation, the president says you're fired.
Well, that's correct. I mean, the senior officer can say, Mr. President, I can no longer serve you. Well, please relieve me of command. That's really what goes on, and then
that kind of letter could be characterized as in quotes as a resignation letter. It's really technically a request to be relieved of command.
That's correct, and they don't resign their commissions either. They go onto the retired list and get all of their retired benefits, and they can be recalled to active duty. So really, what they are, they're relieved of their command, or in the common parlance, fired or sacked or whatever. And you can say in the common parlance that they've resigned. But there has been growing in the last 20 years amongst the military this idea that they can resign on principle.
I see.
And that's a very, very dangerous
development. Well, that's really interesting.
Development, and it in fact undermines civilian control. control. So, I've written about this extensively.
Military officer doesn't resign if he is...
Shouldn't. They can simply ask to be retired.
But if he... But he must... If he... I mean, this is the conflict, or the perceived conflict, is that we think a military officer or a commander who disagrees with the president and can't carry out it in good conscience the president's directions must... get out of there. I mean, he has an obligation not to stay and follow directions that he does not, that he cannot support.
You know, so that's exactly wrong.
What is the deal?
The deal is that the military has a limited perspective and a more or less single agenda, and can't know all of the circumstances that go into a policy, all of the calculations.
Now, Dick,
because
so
beyond them. Now, let me finish.
Well, no, but a general who just totally disagrees says this is a non-winnable approach. I cannot, in good conscience, follow these orders. What? And you're saying he must go forward and do what he does not believe in.
Unless he explains to his civilian superior that that's the case and that it would be better for the country and for the military for him to be replaced. He can make that request. But he neither has the power nor is it proper for him to refuse to serve. That is what I am saying. It is up to the civilian to determine that. And, of course, 999 out of 1,000 cases when faced with that, the civilian will say, well, thank you for telling me. You're right. I'll get someone else. If it's a question of policy or a decision, again, I have to emphasize that the military itself is not in the position to really understand all of the circumstances and issues involved in a decision, and that's simply the case.
Let me ask you. I've got several more questions I wanted to ask you.
I'll give you a good example of that too, if you want.
Let me move on,
okay.
Because you made a very important point and one that. A great learning exercise for me. And I think you can teach me in response to this question as well. I wondered, as the president praised General McChrystal about his accomplishments and his value to the military, and what I thought is that if this were a company, if this were a business, and where a very talented person had shown that he or she was not appropriately placed in a position where he or she could continue to serve, but nevertheless had enormous talents, you wouldn't leave the person. You would reassign them to a place where they could could continue to contribute instead of cashiering them out and losing the benefit of all the experience. Is that just something that can't be done in the military?
Well, the military is an extremely hierarchical organization. And it's very difficult for people to take a step down and retain their pride and their authority. So at that most senior level, it's almost impossible. And a person who violates the norms as seriously as General McChrystal did would not be appropriate to put in another four-star job. Because he or she would not have the confidence of the president.
Well,
they'd be damaged goods.
He's a two-star general. I mean, you say we want to.
Well,
you can't
stay. And in World War II, frequently relieved generals at the two or three star level were reassigned back to the zone of the interior, usually to help and to engage in commands that were very important, supporting the combat troops.
Yeah, I just this is again devil's advocate, but we got a great general who made a terrible mistake, and so we say, okay, instead of using you. You're just blotted forever. You know, you can't.
Well, at that most senior level, that's really the case because they can hardly go back. But at the two-star level or even the three-star level, they could be reassigned, and that has occurred historically. But again, and John Adams made a very important and insightful comment about this once. Military people are people of enormous pride and of great public faith. And it's very hard for them, except in a real national emergency, to kind of continue contributing. And my guess is, DG, that in many businesses at that highest level, a person who's relieved or fired goes to a different company or retires. Whereas in the military, you can only really serve one company. You can't switch to another armed service.
you could go work for the Russian army.
it doesn't work. It's just a very, very different profession and walk of life.
Well, Dick Cone, we don't have time. I've got so many other questions. And the most important one, which we don't have time to discuss, but maybe you'd have a word or two to say about it, and that is the consequence to our civilian-military relations and to the whole country of being involved in interminable war. We're just at war all the time now.
I think it puts a great deal of stress on the military, and it, not just at the highest ranks, but all the way down to the lowest ones. And the consequences are that in difficult times like this, you do get civil-military conflict and tension. And it's really surprising how little we've had since 9/11 of this kind. I think there was a reaction to the civil-military conflict that occurred in the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. Many military people realized it was inappropriate and that they had to renew their professionalism on the subject. So I think it's both natural and it's something to be guarded against because it can be very dangerous. The president has to have full confidence in his military commanders and senior officials and vice versa. And it's very difficult to do so, particularly for a Democrat and particularly for a president who's had as little political experience as President Obama has. But he's reached out to the military in every way conceivable, and I think he has repaired a lot of the relationships. But whether
one of the rules that governs me that I can't break is that when we run out of time, I have to stop even the most wise comments made by a very wise observer of military-civilian relations. Dick Cone, thank you for sharing your wisdom and your time. And we look forward to having you back to talk about some of these things more.
Thank you.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin.